Boker Tov, everybody, or it's a rhyme Tov, Erev Tov, wherever you happen to be. It's a pleasure to once again welcome back Rabbi Adam Mintz. And so we went to Yeshiva University together, so we've known each other for many more years than some people have been alive here. And of course, Rabbi Mintz, I think, he'll correct me if wrong, his first rabbinic position was at a summer at Kehillat Shaarei Torah in Toronto, where he served as the sort of interim rabbi. He didn't yet have smicha. This was before we had smicha. And he served there. That's the rabbi. That's the shul, by the way, Rabbi Reuven Tradberg served for many years and now runs the RCA in Israel, just to let you know about that. So we go back many, many years. Rabbi Mintz grew up in Washington, D.C., really, it's a pleasure to welcome back. His last series was on the history of the Eruv, and this series, of course, will be the history of response literature on conversion, really a fascinating topic, and there have been tremendous, you know, changes, as I imagine we'll hear, on the standards and the approach to conversion. So we look forward to this five-part series. Rabbi Mintz today serves as the he's the founding rabbi of Kilat Re'im Ahuvim on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He teaches in Yeshivat Maharat, and it's always a pleasure to have him. And just before we start, I do want to mention, last night, you know, we've made a number of updates to our website in the last week or so. So we'd be interested to hear your feedback. If you've never visited our website, it's a good time to visit. We got thousands of recordings, articles, all kinds of wonderful stuff to keep you busy learning. So do want to mention that. Okay. Vakasha, Rabbi Mintz, let's go on conversion.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. A treat always to teach for Torah in Motion. And Rabbi Kelman, of course, proves the fact that all rabbinic careers have to start in Toronto, Canada. So nice to be part of this. So what I want to do this semester is I'd like to look at the history of conversion, specifically the history of conversion in America through responsa literature. Now, that seems to be a pretty narrow topic. But what we're going to see is that this topic really addresses a very wide range of topics about American Judaism, specifically American Orthodoxy, throughout the 19th and 20th century and now into the 21st century. Just a word about the history of conversion. We generally think about Ruth, as being the first convert. Whether she was or she wasn't exactly a convert, conversion as we know it, which means non-Jews becoming Jews, is actually something that took off in the time of the Hashmonaim. And the reason for that is that was the first time since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash that the Jews had autonomy, authority. They controlled Judea. And we know the Jews during that period actually went out not only and accepted converts, but actually encouraged and maybe even forced entire nations to convert to Judaism. During the Roman period, there also was some conversion, though less so. But once the Christians took over in the Roman Empire, then in Europe, and the Muslims took over in Islamic countries, in the Middle East and Islamic countries, conversion was more or less stopped. Why was that? In Christian countries, it became forbidden for a Jew to convert a Christian. And in Muslim countries, it became forbidden for a Jew to convert a Muslim. So therefore, the Jews were kind of stuck. So you have conversion from Judaism to these religions, but you don't really have very much conversion to Judaism. Interestingly, and there's been material written on this topic, you do have in the medieval period some conversion within Christian countries. Most of it seems to be Muslims who worked for Jews in Christian countries, who converted to Judaism. You know, that was allowed. If you were a Christian in a Christian country, a Jew couldn't convert you to Judaism. But if you were a Muslim, the Christians didn't care. So we have some Muslims who converted to Judaism. All of this changed around the year 1800, when Jews were granted citizenship in the Central European and the Western European countries. And all of a sudden, Jews and Jews and non-Jews, Jews and Christians interacted. It's what Professor Jacob Katz termed a neutral society. You know, throughout the medieval period, there was no neutral society. There was a Jewish community, there was a Christian community, there was a Jewish community, there was a Muslim community, but you couldn't be in the middle. That, by the way, this is not for now, but that was the problem with Spinoza. He didn't fit anywhere exactly. But in the 1800s, once Jews gained citizenship, so all of a sudden there were a neutral community was established. Means you weren't Jewish or Christian. You were German. You went to German university. You went to German opera. You got together in work. And this German community largely created an assimilation on the part of the Jews. And the conversion rate of Jews to Christianity in Germany during the first half of the middle of the 1800s was significant. But in addition, it raised a lot of different kinds of questions. A Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman, could you give a bar mitzvah to their son? Right? All of these kinds of questions that revolved around conversion. Now, I'm not going to talk about Germany. That's a fascinating topic. There is a book by David Ellenson and Daniel Gordis that talks specifically about the history of conversion to Judaism in the 19th century in Germany. It's a fascinating topic. But we're going to focus on America. And what I want to do is I want to focus on a case that took place in New Orleans in 1864. But in order to give you a background, what I need to do is I need to start by telling you a little bit about the rabbi in New Orleans during this period. The rabbi's name was Rabbi Bernard Illowy, I-L-L-O-W-Y. He was born in 1814 in Bohemia. He came from a long line of rabbis. He actually had smicha, from the Chasam Sofer, and a PhD in languages and classics from the University of Budapest. So he started off being very interesting, right? That wasn't a normal rabbinic way. He was a political revolutionary, and in the middle of around the year 1849 in the Central European countries, there was a big fight between the revolutionaries, between the liberals and the conservatives, and he found himself on the wrong side, and therefore he was forced to flee in 1853. He came first to Shaare Tzedek in New York City. It's interesting, Shaare Tzedek is still a shul on 93rd Street and Broadway in New York City. He then went to Philly, and he was one of the first, not the first, but one of the first Orthodox rabbis in the United States. Now, for a bunch of reasons, he couldn't get settled in one pulpit, and he had seven pulpits in 8 years. One of his issues was that he attacked the reform movement. He, for instance, defended the second day of Yontif, even though the reform movement wanted to eliminate the second day of Yontif. He attacked Isaac Mayer Wise, who was really the founder of the American reform movement. So he was very much a player in the American rabbinate, and he was a defender of orthodoxy against the reform movement. In 1856, Rabbi Illowy was invited by a shul called Shaare Chesed in New Orleans to be the rabbi. For personal reasons that we're not exactly sure what they are, he accepted only in 1861. So in 1861, he moves to New Orleans. He makes a salary of $2,000 a year. Now, you have to know something about the 1860s, the first half of the 1860s in New Orleans. And that is that New Orleans finds itself right in the middle of the Civil War. Actually, the New Orleans was captured by the North in 1862. That was a significant turning point in the war. So New Orleans was a very important city. Rabbi Eloy was very careful. He opposed slavery, but he was very careful in the way he negotiated his position in New Orleans. But that was an important place to be. New Orleans during this period was really, really important. Now, to give you a sense, we don't know exactly how many Jews lived in New Orleans during this period. But nevertheless, I can give you a picture of what New Orleans looked like. The first thing I can tell you is that there was no Reform congregation in New Orleans in the 1860s. That in itself is kind of interesting, right? The Reform movement is beginning in the United States and gaining prominence in the United States. But New Orleans was not a center of the Reform movement. So all Judaism in New Orleans, whatever your practice was, all Judaism was through the Orthodox synagogue. Yet, in 1830, the report is, there was a 50% intermarriage rate, which is obviously a very high intermarriage rate. You have to remember for a minute when you think we'll come back to this. In 1850, intermarriage wasn't only an issue about what the Jews thought, right? About whether a Jew wants to marry an American, a non-Jew. Intermarriage is also an issue about whether the American wanted to marry the Jews, right? In 1850, most Americans didn't want to marry Jews. So therefore, you say a 50% intermarriage rate, that's a very high intermarriage rate. That probably means that most of the Jews in New Orleans weren't really identified as Jews. They were so American that the Americans didn't care. They were happy to marry the Jews. To give you a sense of this, and this you'll all appreciate, there actually was a special section in the Jewish cemetery for the non-Jewish spouses of Jews. Now, that's pretty remarkable, right? Can you imagine that? You know today that non-Jews are not married in the Jewish cemetery. But if 50% of your 50% of your congregation is intermarried, so then you're going to need to have a place for the non-Jewish spouses. So they actually had a special section in the cemetery where the non-Jewish spouses were allowed to be buried. That's our story. That's our background. That takes us to 1864 in New Orleans. Now, I'm going to do something with you today, which I think is really a special treat. And that is, I'm going to tell the story of what happened in New Orleans through primary sources that described the situation that were written at the time in the moment. That's really a remarkable thing. 1864, we're going to read documents that tell you a story about what happened in 1864 in New Orleans. Obviously, we'll read the documents. I'll read a little piece, then we'll discuss them. And I think what's going to come to life is an issue that was an issue in 1864 in New Orleans, which was actually commented upon by the rabbis of Germany. And we'll look at the Tshuvot from Germany as well. But I think we're going to see some things here that are very, very familiar. So let's get going here, everybody. Okay. I'm reading from a book. The book is called Sefer Milchamot Elohim, being the controversial letters and the casuistic decisions of the late Rabbi Bernard Eloy, Ph.D., with a short history of his life and his activity by his son, Henry Eloy, M.D., published in Berlin in 1914. Right here, Rabbi Kelman, we can spend the next 45 minutes right here on this title page. First of all, Henry Eloy, his son, was an MD. That's interesting, right? They look, there's a whole description of what he did, but he was an MD. So the rabbi's son became a doctor. No different than today. Sefer Milchamot Elohim, the battles of the Lord. Now it says being. The translation in English is actually not what the Hebrew means. The English is the controversial letters and the casuistic decisions of the late Rabbi Bernard Eloy. He was an antagonist. He was a troublemaker, Rabbi Eloy. These are his controversial letters, which are collected by his son. Most of the letters have to do with his attack against the Reform movement. But we're going to read a different story here. Here we go. Okay. I'm going to read here something from the Jewish Messenger, New York, November 11th, 1864. What is the Jewish Messenger? The Jewish Messenger was a Jewish newspaper that was begun in 1857. It was read by Jews, by Orthodox Jews, non-Orthodox Jews, by rabbis, by lay people. As you'll see in a second, if you live in New Orleans and you want to share what's going on in New Orleans, then you need to publish your story in the Jewish Messenger. New Orleans, October 27th, 1864, to the Reverend S.M. Isaacs and Son, editors of the Jewish Messenger. Gentlemen, okay, this is written by somebody in New Orleans. It seems that you have no regular correspondent in this city. Otherwise, he could give you matter enough to have also New Orleans mentioned in the domestic column of your valuable paper. So the first thing he does is he criticizes the newspaper. You don't have a reporter in New Orleans. New Orleans is an important Jewish community, and you don't have a reporter in New Orleans. I take, therefore, the liberty to forward you some short items regarding religious affairs in New Orleans. About 2 months ago, Dr. Eloy sent an official letter to the Mohalim of this city, in which he requested them not to circumcise in future any child born from a Christian mother, though that the father is an Israelite, for the following reasons. Okay? Before I read the reasons, we need to just make sure we're clear on the on what's going on here. So Rabbi Eloy, in October of 1864, he tells the Mohalim in New Orleans they are not allowed to circumcise the children of non-Jewish mothers, even though they have a Jewish father. Now, why do you think that someone would want to circumcise the child of a non-Jewish mother? That child of a non-Jewish mother, is that child Jewish or non-Jewish? That child is not Jewish. So what's the situation? Why would the father and or the mother, why would they want to circumcise that child? You tell me for a minute. I'll open it up for 1 second. Why would they want to circumcise them? Why would they want to circumcise that child? Any thoughts? Any very quick thoughts?
For the purpose of conversion.
Ah. So maybe it's for the purpose of conversion, okay? No. Meaning that this is the first step of conversion. Now the mother's not converting, but maybe the child will convert. Okay? One more chance. Any other thoughts?
Yes. To be like the father.
To be like the father. So not to convert, but at least to have a bris, because the father has a bris, so the child has a bris. Okay, right. Good. Exactly. That's perfect. So basically, there might be two possible reasons why the Jewish father and the non-Jewish mother would want to convert the child. Either as the first step towards conversion, or just to be like the Jewish father, you know, even though the child will not be converted, will not actually convert. So now let's see what Rabbi Eloy thinks about those reasons and whether he's whether he's in agreement or disagreement or what's going on here. Okay, so here we go. So Here we go. First, the first reason that he's against doing this, it is evident that the circumcision is not performed l'shem gerus, but only for the purpose of being entitled to a portion of ground on the Jewish burial place in case of death. And according to the law, the ceremony of circumcision can be performed only l'shem gerus, after which the ceremony of tefillah has to be followed, while amongst all those already circumcised children of Christian mothers, of whom some have already reached the age of 5 and others of 6, there is not one that had tefillah. Though Dr. Eloi explained to some of the parents that their children cannot be regarded by law as Israelites, as long as tefillah is not performed, the father but not the mother would yield to the exigencies of the law. So, the first suggestion you made was that what? The first suggestion was that the reason the parents wanted to convert the child was as a form of conversion. So that's the first thing Rabbi Eloi says. That's not why they're doing it. They're not doing it to convert. How do you know they're not doing it to convert? The reason you know they're not doing it to convert is because there are several children who are 5 and 6 years old and they still haven't converted. So clearly that wasn't why they wanted to convert them. Now you said, someone else said, that the reason they wanted to have them circumcised is so they could be like the father. He says it was more practical. They wanted to make sure they could be buried in the Jewish cemetery. Now, I don't know exactly why they would be buried in the Jewish cemetery if they were circumcised, even though they weren't Jewish, but it seems to be that that's what they thought. So this first opposition, his first reason of opposition is that there's no reason to circumcise the child because they're not going to convert the child anyway. Now, deep down, of course, there's a problem. If you're going to circumcise the child and you're not going to then bring him to the mikvah, so it's possible that people might think that the child is Jewish. And that would be problematic, right? So let's see what else we have here. Number 2, since the circumcision is not performed, the Shin Gerus, the Mo'el, not only that he acts contrary to the law, but he also transgresses the prohibition, Losisa, by making a bracha levatala. Okay, Ray Silverberg, that's a frum reason, right? Means it's a bracha levatala. Means how can you make a bracha? Because let me just explain the halacha. If a Mo'el gives the bris to a non-Jewish child as a means of circumcision, so he makes a bracha, bracha to Hashem, elokeinu melech olam, there's a special bracha. But since this kid is not going to convert, so he's making a bracha levatala. We'll leave aside that question. Number 3, third. Suppose everything would be done according to the law, both tefillah and milah. What, however, has Judaism to hope of a child educated by a Christian mother and an irreligious father? Have we not enough banim mashchisim of our own? Banim mashchisim means, wayward children who would not know that they are Jews were they not circumcised. Why shall we, under the cover of religion, increase their number? Now, number 3 is actually remarkable. Absolutely remarkable, number 3. Number 3 says, number 1 said they're not going to convert anyway. Nobody goes to the mikvah. Number 3 says, even if they convert, we don't want them. Why don't we want them? Because what good are kids who have non-Jewish mothers and Jewish fathers? They're not any good for us. We don't need them. So therefore, why bother converting them? Now that, listen everybody, that's a very different argument than number 1. Number 1 says they're not going to convert. Number 3 says, even if they convert, we don't want them. Now, that's also fascinating. And you think today about, that that theory. You know, would a Beis Din in America, in Israel, and anywhere you want to choose, in Toronto, would any Beis Din convert the child of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother in a situation where the mother would not convert? Right? Again, that's the case here. The mother is not converting. So would a Beis Din convert the child of an irreligious Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother if the mother did not convert? That's a good question. Let me just take the question from the chat. One second. Rabbi Loewy, great-granddaughter lives in Israel. That's fantastic. Is there a standard prohibition for a mohel to circumcise a non-Jewish baby? Neither parent Jewish, but they want the procedure done by a mohel. That's a good question. We'll see that in the tshuva coming up. The answer is no. There is no prohibition for a mohel to circumcise a non-Jew, even if that non-Jew is not gonna convert to Judaism. So it's not a technical problem. It's an issue about an approach to Mila. So three reasons Rabbi Loewy says. Rabbi Loewy said that the mohel cannot circumcise this child of the Jewish father, non-Jewish mother. Number one, they're not going to convert anyway. Number two, it's a bracha levatala. And number three is, even if they convert, we don't want them. Because what kind of Jew is that going to be? We have enough wayward Jewish children. What do we want more for? Okay, that's every single thing here is remarkable to think that this is what they were talking about in 1864. And now he's going to go on, this man who's telling you the story. Dr. Loewy made the above explanation to the Board of Trustees. Also great, right? Okay. There was a board meeting who assisted him, and two of the other Moalim, who are members of the congregation, were notified that it is the desire of the board that they should act according to the decision of the rabbi, to which they agreed. So two Moalim agreed with the rabbi. They weren't going to give a bris to these kids anymore. But now, as always, there's another mohel. But the third mohel wrote 2 weeks after I had received Dr. Eloy's letter, a very insulting answer in which he declared that he has done so before and will continue so to circumcise all children born of Christian mothers. Dr. Eloy, after having received that insulting answer of the mohel, declared him publicly in the synagogue as posel, having forfeited his right as mohel, and being in future unfit for and unworthy of the holy office. This event gave rise partly to a dissatisfaction among the friends of the Mohel and those whose wives are strangers, Nachriot, to our nation. Okay, so first of all, who got angry at him? Number one, the friends of the Mohel, who he just said can't do a meal anymore, they got angry. Who else got angry? The members of the shul, whose wives are non-Jews, they also got angry. And partly to a dispute among impartial individuals about the correctness of Dr. Eloy's decision. So basically, there's a fight in the shul. There's a split in the shul about whether Rabbi Eloy is right or wrong. Permit me, therefore, gentlemen, says this man, to lay before you and your learned readers three questions. Three questions, okay? Number one. Is it permitted according to the law to circumcise the son of a Christian mother and an irreligious Jewish father, though we know beforehand that we have not a spark of hope that the child will ever be brought up as a Jew? Suppose it be not permitted. Has any rabbi the right to declare a mohel who acted contrary to his decision in said question as posel and unfit to perform in future the ceremony of circumcision? And third, suppose the rabbi had such a right to declare a mohel as posel. Is then the psul resting upon the mohel, or is it likewise sinful in every individual who will allow such a mohel to circumcise his child? So basically, ask three questions. Okay, that one of those questions is the question somebody asked in the chat. Number one is there a prohibition against doing such a milah, right, of a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother? Is there such a prohibition? And if there is a prohibition, does the rabbi have the right to say that such a mo'el is possible in other cases, right? You understand, of course, that this is taking away the mo'el's livelihood, right? This is what the mo'el did. So are you allowed to do that? And number three is, so say the rabbi says you can't do it, and the mo'el does it anyway. Is it prohibited from the community from using this mo'el? That's what this man tries to ask, okay? That's what this man tries to ask. Let's see what he says. Let's see what he says. So hoping that you will grant these questions a space in the columns of your valuable paper and let us hear in the next number of the messenger your own opinion, as well as those as other learned men in Israel. I can assure you, gentlemen, that by doing so, you will restore the peace into the hearts of those who are now dissatisfied with the decision of Rabbi Reverend Dr. Elohi. So basically, he wants the messenger to tell him what the decision is, basically to defend Rabbi Elohi. Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. There were this year over 50 sukkahs in our city, of which over 40 were built by the members of the congregation Shari Chesed, Rampart Street. Whilst 3 years ago, when Dr. Elohi arrived in the city, there was but one sukkah built by the sexton of the Portuguese congregation in the yard of their synagogue. Though it is true that the reverend gentleman worked indefatigably with patience and perseverance to keep the word of God alive in the community, still it must be admitted that praise enough cannot be bestowed on S. Friedlander, Esquire, president of the congregation, not alone for the powerful support he is to the rabbi, not alone for the able management through which he made the congregation flourish and increase to such a number of members that the synagogue, spacious as it is, has no more room for any newcomers, but also for the strictness and conscious care with which he watches the sacred altar of God, that it not be desecrated by the unholy fire of reform. He stands at the doors of the synagogue like the cherubim before the Garden of Eden, with the flaming sword in his hand, granting no admittance to those of whom God said, Lo yavo b'kal Hashem. This is probably the principal cause that the goats commence now to separate. To separate themselves from the sheep, so kudshim, and seek a better pasture, where they can find food entirely agreeable to their taste. I need not tell you anymore that a reformed society will soon be organized in New Orleans. The Knight Templars already show great activity and circulate for that purpose. Circulars for that purpose are already distributed. H.I. Almoni, we don't know who he is. Obviously, he's someone in the shul who's a supporter of Rabbi Elohi. He says Rabbi Elohi does a good job. And Rabbi Elohi built 50 sukkahs in New Orleans since he came. That's an amazing thing. And even though the president gets some credit, but it's because of the rabbi. They have so many sukkahs. So he's a good rabbi. And not only that, he says, this rabbi is preventing a reform society. There's no reform in New Orleans. So now the messenger answers. Number one, we readily endorse the decision of Dr. Elohi respecting the admission of the sons of a non-Israelitish woman into the covenant of Abraham. Okay? So we readily endorse a decision respecting the admission of the sons of a non-Israelite woman into the covenant of Abraham. That's a funny thing. It's hard to know exactly what that means. Does that mean that the Moel's not allowed to do the bris? Does it mean that you're allowed to have conversion? It's not entirely clear. Let's say that they respect him, that the Moel shouldn't do it. Two and three. The authority of the rabbi in this country being unfortunately limited by his moral influence, Dr. Elohi had no power to enforce his decision by preventing a mo'el from acting as such. If the Israelites of any city are willing to have the function of mo'el exercised by a man pronounced unfit for good and sufficient reasons, it is a fact, however painful and deplorable, that there exists no acknowledged authority to restrain their liberty of actions. Outside of his own synagogue, a chazan or rabbi in America is invested with no power whatsoever beyond expounding the law editors. So that is also amazing. Again, what is the answer? So here you go. This guy writes a letter to the messenger, 1864. He writes a letter to the messenger. He says, this is what happened. We have a crisis in our shul. Can you imagine if that's the way, Rabbi Kelman, that they resolve crises in shuls? There's a crisis in the shul in New Orleans. Nobody knows about it. I'm going to write to the Jewish newspaper. I don't even know what the Jewish newspaper is anymore. Right? In the old days, it would be the Jewish Week. Right? You'd write to the Jewish Week, the Jewish Observer. So I want to tell you what's going on in New Orleans. There's no internet. There's no email. So I'm going to tell you, there's no social media. I'm going to tell you what's going on in New Orleans. There's a fight. Rabbi Elohi will not allow the bris of a child of a Jewish man and non-Jewish woman. And not only that, but he says that Moel can't be a Moel anymore. And nobody's allowed to use him as a Moel. And this guy says, I like Rabbi Elohi. And he knows what he's doing. And he built a lot of sukkahs in the city. And he's preventing the reform movement from the city. And the editors answer. And what do the editors say? Let's imagine what the editors say is Rabbi Elohi's right. We support Rabbi Elohi. That he shouldn't give a bris milah to the son of a Jewish man and not a Jewish woman. Okay, that's what he says. But he has no authority. He has no authority. It's America. He can't say that the Moel can't be a Moel. If the Moel wants to be a Moel, the Moel can be a Moel. If the families want to use the Moel, then the families are allowed to use the Moel. Now, I guess that he can prohibit the Moel doing these circumcisions in his shul, but he can't say that the Moel is not allowed to be a Moel. Okay. 1 minute here. Two comments, if you want. What do you think? What do you think about the position of this man who wrote the letter to the messenger supporting Rabbi Elohi? And what do you think about the response of the editors? Any quick comments? Two comments.
Well, he does have authority to prevent burial of the son of the circumcised boy. And perhaps of the father.
Only in his own cemetery. Yeah, if it's his personal cemetery, he could. Okay, good. But the kid, the baby is 8 days old. The baby's not dying yet. So that doesn't seem to be the issue. One more comment. Any other comments on this? Okay. So this question went to Europe. Okay, this question went to Europe, meaning that they wrote it in the messenger. And it seems to be that this was picked up in the German newspapers again. We'll see where it was picked up specifically. And generally, the rabbis in Germany, Rabbi Samson, Raphael Hirsch among them, supported Rabbi Elohi. You can't give a bris to these children, and that he has a right to get rid of the Moel if he wants to. They seem to have supported Rabbi Elohi. But Rabbi Elohi was in a bad spot because there was a split in his shul, and the editors of the messenger did not support him getting rid of the Moel. So in the next issue of the messenger, there actually is a response by Rabbi Elohi himself. Again, we're seeing this play out in real time. 1864 in real time. This battle that was going on in the shul in New Orleans, and we'll see in a minute, affected the rabbis in Europe as well. This is being played out in real time in the pages of the messenger. And let's just look a little bit here. Let me just look at the questions. The use of the title Reverend instead of Rabbi is interesting. It's a Reverend still used in England. Yeah, and it's a British system. That's okay. B'dieved. Yeah, we're going to get to Zera Kodesh in a second. Okay, we'll get there. Rabbi Kalischer talks about that. We'll get there in a second. Don't jump the gun. Okay, here we go. So here we go. There's a long answer here from Dr. Lehman in Mainz. It's in German, so we'll allow Rabbi Kelman to read that for you some other time. Here we go. Okay. There we go. Editorial remark. This is February 3rd, 1865. Editorial remark. We have heretofore called attention to the controversy agitating our co-religionists at New Orleans on the subject of the Moel who has been suspended for duty by Dr. Eloi, the rabbi of the congregation. It appears that the doctor had been called upon to retract his position, and a communication had been made to him by the officers of the congregation with which Mr. Goldenberg, he's the Moel, was identified, demanding a withdrawal of his censure. Dr. Eloi requests us to publish the following reply, which he transmitted to this request. It is proper to say that his action is fully endorsed by Rabbi Hirsch of Frankfurt and other high authorities. We have already stated our conviction that the doctor's course was dictated by an earnest purpose of serving Israel and perpetuating the purity of the rite of circumcision and was in accordance with the correct precedent. Okay? So basically, the messenger is saying that Rabbi Eloi is supported by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch of Frankfurt. That's amazing. 1865. Rabbi Hirsch, right? It's the real deal. And the editors seem to be supporting him as well. This is a letter written by Rabbi Eloi. I hereby most respectfully acknowledge the receipt of your favor dated the 28th of December, in which you request me by order of your congregation to recall what I have publicly pronounced against Mr. Goldenberg, a member of your congregation. Believe me, gentlemen, and the Almighty who sees into man's heart, he alone knows it, that I never felt the least animosity against the person of Mr. Goldenberg. And would my conscience tell me that I have done him wrong, I would not hesitate a moment to ask his forgiveness and revoke my declaration. But since I am perfectly convinced that I have acted fully in accordance with our sacred code, I regret my not being able to comply with your desire. I am not going to take back my sock. I further beg leave, gentlemen, to state before you the case in its true shape, that you may be better able to judge whether that what I have done was in consistency with duty, law, and justice or not. It is very true, as everyone who is but slightly acquainted with the Hebrew language without being a theological scholar can read in Hilchos Geirim, that the male child of a non-Israelite mother can be admitted into Judaism and brought into the covenant of Abraham. And there is no need to hear first the opinion of European rabbis about it. Every layman will know how to decide this question. It is, however, not to be overlooked that the admission of a child into Judaism is subject, like that of an adult, to the condition that the Beis Din must first be at least apparently convinced that there is no other motive that impels the proselyte to embrace Judaism than true and sincere conversion. So you can convert, but you can't have an ulterior motive. I have further to remark that though the law permits the proper authority to admit a non-Israelite into Judaism, it is still not more than a permission granted by the law. By no means, however, can it be regarded as a mitzvah, a religious duty enjoined upon us, because experience has shown that in all ages, proselytes have done Judaism more harm than good. As Rabbi Chelbo says, Kashim Geirim Li Yisrael Kisapachas. Proselytes are as hurtful to Judaism as leprosy is to the body. Now, it goes on, but we don't need to read anymore. What do we see here? What we see here is a very interesting thing. Here, Rabbi Eloi has his back against the wall. Okay, this is great shul politics. How often do you get to see shul politics from 1864, 1865? Rabbi Eloi is in trouble. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch says he was right. You shouldn't do the bris. Maybe you should even fire the moel. The editors of the Messenger support Rabbi Eloi. But he's in trouble in shul. The moel obviously has his supporters. And Rabbi Eloi is being pushed to retract his decree. So what does Rabbi Eloi say? he takes an interesting approach to this. His approach is to say, you know what? Let's say you're all right. Let's say that basically the Moel's allowed to do the bris. Why is the Moel allowed to do the bris? Because the bris is the first step in conversion, right? And therefore he's allowed to do it. It's the first step in conversion. Let's say you're all right. Rabbi Lowy thought that nobody's going to convert, but let's imagine that you're right. He says, we don't really want converts. Kashim geirim li Yisrael kisapachas. Converts are problematic to the Jews like a scab. It's a question exactly what that means. But the way he's using it, it means that Jews are no good. Right? Converts are no good. Converts are a problem. Converts, let's say, will go back to their old ways somehow. Or Jews maybe will learn bad practices from the converts. We don't want converts. So Rabbi Lowy, with his back against the wall, probably argues something. For sure, it's something that's not the issue here. And maybe it's something that he doesn't even believe. You see, the reason he doesn't allow the bris here is because he doesn't want these children to be in this middle state where they're circumcised but not Jewish, lest people will think that they're really Jewish, right? Less people will think that they're really Jewish, and that'll be problematic. And since nobody has converted yet from this group, he doesn't believe they'll convert. So they'll be in this interim stage, and that'll be bad. That'll be kind of ambiguous, or that'll be misleading going forward. But he doesn't say that directly. He feels that his position is strongest by saying something else, that we don't really want converts. Even if they convert, we don't really want converts. Now, that's very interesting. That shows you that when your back's against the wall, you argue something that's not even the point, because if we don't want converts, then who cares about the whole thing? Then you shouldn't deal with these kids. If these kids are the children of non-Jewish wives, then we're not interested in them. They're not Jewish. We don't want converts. And therefore, we don't want these kids at all. It's different than the original point about whether or not it's good to have someone in this middle state, in which he thought that was problematic. Now he changes to say, no, the reason I'm against it is because I don't like converts at all. Let me just see what the chat is, and then we'll go on. What I have never before heard objection to a truly believing convert to Judaism. He doesn't object to that. What he objects to is he says, you can't trust these people. Wondering why Rabbi Lowy emphasized the ulterior motive in the Medrash about Sapachas instead of Kabbalah Samitzvos. Right. Okay. That's a good question. Maybe because he was seeing the son of a Gentile woman to a secular Jew or something converted to Judaism. Is that the Toronto Bezer refused a conversion for marriage? Okay. That you have to ask Rabbi Kelman. That's not my department. You're right. I mean, you're right. You see, there are a lot of things he could have said, but what he says is, no, we don't like converts. Not because they don't accept the mitzvos. We generally don't like converts. We accept converts. There's no halacha against, but it's not a mitzvah to accept them, and we don't really trust them because they're like a scam. And therefore, we shouldn't accept these kids. Rabbi Lowy is in trouble, right? Rabbi Lowy is in trouble. In truth, Rabbi Lowy eventually had to leave his job, and you see that he's right, that he's controversial, right? That's what the letters are. They're controversial. He's controversial, and clearly he didn't get away with it. The Moel had more friends than the rabbi. But I can't end here. Because actually this issue, as I said, got to Europe. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch said that Rabbi Lowy was right not to give a bris to the child. Actually, there's a debate in the Tshuvos of Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer at the time was the head of the rabbinical seminary in Berlin. Hirsch was in Frankfurt. Hildesheimer was in Berlin. Hildesheimer has a back and forth by a Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. who dies in 1874. You may know the name Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. He was really one of the early proto-religious Zionists. But he was also a well-respected rabbi during the period. And I want to read to you what Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer writes on this topic. It's remarkable, absolutely remarkable. This is in the Tshuvos of Rabbi Hildesheimer. This is the words of Rabbi Kalischer. In Karati Ba'ale Israelite. Okay, I read in the newspaper Israelite, which was the newspaper that the German Jewish newspaper, number 52, right? And 5-2, whatever. Gimel Shelot Asher Hutzkuba Bikurei Team Shel America. Says three questions that were raised in America. Lasher Karabe Orleans. He didn't even know you called it New Orleans. He just called it Orleans. Jewish men who sinned by marrying non-Jewish women, they had children. But now, even though they sinned, but the Jewishness, the spark of Judaism, led them to want to circumcise their children. And the mothers, even though they didn't prevent the bris, but they didn't allow a tefillah. He says he prohibited the bris. Because he got angry at these sinners. And not only that, but it's a sin for the Moel to circumcise them. Upasal es haMoel ha'uved avodah zarah, and upasal es haMoel ha'uver al zeh, sorry, ula avahu yimatzei avod. He says the Moel was sinning and the father was sinning. Valzei richu b'nei America gimel sheilot, and they asked the three questions: im yesh avon lefi adat mamul badim kaila, can you not circumcise such children? Im yesh larav lipsol hamoel shana tafkido, can you throw out the moel? Im liyisrael akar ashiitem b'no lamoel de avon yichashiv lo, if another Jew has him circumcise his child, is that a sin? And he has a tshuva, a long tshuva. The first tshuva answers a question that one of you asked before, and that is there a prohibition against a moel circumcising a non-Jew? And he says no. But I want to read the next page. He says like this, the bottom on the right column. V'ata, I'll read this slowly. Im ba'akum hadin kein, shein ba'zeh avon, that if it's true that circumcising a total non-Jew is not a sin, rak mitzvah, kol shekein biyeled, asher aviv Yisrael v'imo hanachris, lo timache mehemilo. Says for sure, a child whose father is Jewish and mother is not Jewish, you should not prevent the bris. Shemitzuvim anu liftoach lo petach tikva lamulo ka'et al dat aviv. Because we have a mitzvah to open up an opening of hope based on what the father wants to do now. Ukishi yigdal yuchal maher lasot kirtzon aviv litbo latzmo kedatu chedid. He says you have to give him a chance. If he has a bris, maybe he'll go to the mikvah later. If he doesn't have a bris, there's no way he'll have a bris later, right? Even today, men don't want to have a bris when they're adults. For then, in 1865, you could be sure. The ode, and one little more thing. Yesh la'orer shetfila kazu asher aviv Yisrael, yoter mechu yavin lahachin lo derech habechira. He says, and if your father is Jewish, there really is more of a reason to give him this choice. Me'asher ya'aseh lahanolad minachri. in more so than in the case if the father's not Jewish. Ki agam shemidina havlad kimota linyan yichus. Even though the halacha is that the child is like Hirsch, he's not Jewish. Al kolzeh matzinu kizera hakodesh yikarei. Nevertheless, if your father is Jewish, you have a different status. Your status is that you're called something Zera Yisrael. And for Zera Yisrael, we need to bend over backwards to give him a chance to convert. Wow. That tshuva is a wow. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer in 1865 says, the son of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, you need, not only are you allowed, you need to circumcise that child. Because by circumcising the child, you are giving the child the chance to convert to Judaism. If you don't circumcise the child, he'll never convert to Judaism. And even if you want to say that if the father's not Jewish, you shouldn't give the child a chance. But if the child is Jewish, there is no question he's Zera Kodesh. And you should give him the chance to convert to Judaism. Rabbi Elohi was against this. Rabbi Elohi says, we don't want these children circumcised but not converted. They're not really going to convert. Rabbi Kalischer said, no, you have to give him the chance. Rabbi Kalischer, to me, sounds much more modern, understands the opportunity to, as a first step, to allow this person to enter Judaism. David Ellenson, in an article that he wrote about this topic, he suggests that maybe Rabbi Kalischer, living in Germany, in what was basically a shtetl in northern Germany, he might not have been exposed to these kinds of families. And therefore, he wrote his tshuva kind of in an idealistic sense. This would be nice. This child will have a bris, and he'll convert to Judaism. Rabbi Elohi is probably writing in a much more pragmatic feel. He knew the story. He knew that this child who was circumcised is not going to convert. They had 5 and 6 year old children and they didn't convert. So while Rabbi Elohi sounds to our ears to be more modern, to be more accepting, but it is interesting that in this moment, Rabbi Elohi might have had a better understanding in what the situation was in New Orleans. Anyway, what you see here is a story, a fight in the shul in New Orleans in 1864. Rabbi Elohi got in trouble and ultimately lost his job. What they were arguing about was about conversion, was about children of non-Jewish mothers and Jewish fathers. Do we give them a chance? Are we realistic to say they're not really converting? And what's remarkable, of course, is that many of these same questions are questions that we address in the 21st century today. Thank you, everybody. I look forward to continuing. And what we're going to do over the course of this semester is we're going to kind of trace different examples of tshuvot which deal with different issues regarding conversion. Let me just take 1 second to answer this. Is Kalischer correct in calling the bris of a Christian mother's son a mitzvah? He thinks it's a mitzvah because it's the first step of conversion. By the way, the editor of Der Israelite, a German Jewish newspaper with Dr. Marcus Lehman, authored many books, right? Correct. He was a son-in-law of Rabbi Samson Bader, well-known Moel. That's interesting. Okay. That's interesting. He was connected to bris. Okay. Okay. Great. Looking forward to seeing everybody next week. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. Be well.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you. Yasher Koach. Okay. All right. This is, of course, the problem of with the Russians. I don't know if you'll get there, but, there's areas throughout. This is, and the question really, should we have much more lenient standards of conversion? That's what you didn't really address that even the standards for conversion should be much lower for Zeri Israel. That's a lot of halachic, obviously, whatever. Yes.
Correct. And that's remarkable that in 1865, he was already sensitive to that category.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And by the way, for people, I know for people who don't know, Rabbi Yehoshua Kalinger was a top student of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He wasn't some fly-by-night rabbi writing a tshuva. This is like, all the rabbi, you know, I think he's more well-known halachically than Rabbi Elohi. I mean, you know, in terms of...
No, his, for sure he is. And the fact that he's going back and forth with Rabbi Hildesheimer shows that he was respected in the German Orthodox world.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely right. Thank you so much.
Rabbi Mintz.
Be well, everybody.
Okay.